My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Thank you, Irving. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Dick and I were together some months back when he brought up this idea, this Woodstock in the South idea. Dick's my kind of guy. Dick thinks big, you know. And then to see the idea come into fruition and to be a part of it. It's humbling for a guy like me. It's really humbling for a guy like me and somewhat intimidating to be with the group of people who will be presenting this weekend. Thanks, Dick, for setting it up the way you set it up so that I don't have to immediately follow Tom Ivester. At least you guys had a night to sleep it off and you don't have to. One of my favorite people and one of my favorite mentors in this program and the people that will be following and preceding and following me, you know, have been my mentors in this fellowship. And if you're anything like me and you come from where I come from, the idea of needing mentorship, I'm a grown man, you can't tell me nothing, was my attitude when I came in here. And so that has been a 360-degree change for a guy named Ralph. You know, I'm honored and to get the opportunity to come up here and share with you guys. I'm glad I don't have to go through. You know, the process of recovery that's outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is absolutely one of my favorite things to talk about. And more importantly, I try to live it as best I can. You know, and this is one of my favorite weekends. You know, I've been had the opportunity to see some people do the same deal at State Line. You know, and the importance of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, I listened to Tom talk about last night. Taking some people and getting with a group of people and reading this book line by line, page by page, you know. And one of the things that I learned when I first came into the program of recovery, you know, the importance of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of the forwards that calls it our basic text for recovery. And so I was doing the deal, and I fell in love with the fellowship before I fell in love with the program. You know, I'm like, I don't know, I guess it was Tom or maybe Bob that talked about it. I think maybe Bob talked about it. He never had a problem when he came in because he loved the program from the beginning. And that was me, my fourth time. I had tried it three other times. But the fourth time I came, you know, I fell in love with the program of recovery. And I fell in love with the unity side of our triangle, the fellowship side. And I would go to meetings, and meetings became the high point of my day. And I look forward to getting with you guys. I was deep in the life, and I'm one of the ones that descended all the way to the bottom. And my, you know, even though, you know, alcoholism is not measured by the outside stuff, what I did when I was under the influence, for me, I'm one of the ones that descended all the way into that. I started living in what I like to call that underworld. You know, I'm one of the ones that was what it was for me every single day, all day. I'm either doing it, I'm either trying to do it, or I'm either coming down from it. That's it. That's all. That was my state. And I got to the point where I was drinking to stop from thinking about where drinking had taken me. That's the only thing it was doing for me. I'm one of those guys. Went all the way to the bottom. And so when I got in the program of recovery, it got real important for me to counteract that. And so what I had to do was the same thing. I'm a mad dog in the life, and I'm a mad dog in recovery. And I don't mean it in a bad way. I'm not one of the ones that's, you know, the fervor of the newly converted. No, I'm not like that, you know. Oh, let's close down all the LIQs and let's do, you know. But I'm one of the ones that, you know, when I get in something, I like to know everything about it. You know, when I was I knew how to mix drinks. I studied it, and I could tell you, you know, I'm one of the guys that subscribed to High Times, and I read it, and I could, you know, tell you how to hang a plant upside down, and, you know, all that stuff. You know, when I get in a subject, I grab hold of it, you know, because it's what I do. It's what I do. And when I got in the, and it becomes a lifestyle for me. And when I got in the process of recovery, it became a lifestyle for me. You know, a manner of living. The book talks about a design for living, and more importantly, that really works. You know, so I got hold of this thing, and some people presented it in a way, because I read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you could say, why do I need to read that book anyway? Why can't I just go to meetings, listen to what people share, you know, and then just take it from there? You know, I love when Tom said you can stop wherever you were for whatever you're willing to settle for. That's cool. That's cool. But if you're one of the ones that when everybody else go home, you still at the party? You my kind of person. You know, yeah. It's some people that sit around and, okay, when it's all done, it's all done. I never concede it's all done. You know, it's still some more we can do, you know. And I'm like that in recovery, you know, like that in recovery. So, you know, some people introduced me to this book, this basic text, and trust me, you know what it is it's an outline, and it's a guideline. God is not contained inside 164 pages of a blue book. You know, God's not contained in there. But the directions for a guy like me to form a conscious contact that can sustain me in all conditions, in all circumstances, and give me the power to say, no, thank you, I'm not drinking. The directions to connect with a power like that are contained in this book for me. So I set about that journey, and I learned some things about the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. For every single one of the steps that's outlined in the book is going to do three things for me. It's going to give me, tell me why I need to take that step. Why I need to take it, you know. Then it's going to give me precise instructions on how to apply that step to my life. Then it's going to do the third thing for me, the thing I like the most. You know, tell me the results I get as a result of applying that step. We call them promises. We all know about the ninth step promises, but there are promises that follow each and every one of our steps. And many of us have tasted the fruits of those promises. And that's what I live for. So Tom already outlined the first three steps in recovery, you know, and each one of the steps is, you know, some people talk about you know, I know how to apply a step, or I work a step when I get to a situation. I don't know about that. It's an integrated series of activities and actions which form a lifestyle for me. I can't tell you a discrete thing I'm doing except for a couple. I can tell you when I'm doing a fourth step, and I can tell you when I'm doing a ninth step. You know, but pretty much the rest of it is, it's the way that I live my life. You know, that first step for me was a conclusion I drew based on my experience. It's not something I came in here and decided I'm going to be powerless over alcohol. Alcohol decided that for me. Thank you very much. And I took a look at my experience, in the light of my experience, with some knowledge and information that you guys armed me with, and I was able to see the truth about my condition. I had always known I was bodily different, but I didn't understand that conceptually right, you know. I thought I was bodily different. Yeah, I got high capacity. That's why I'm bodily different. I got higher capacity. That's why I drink so much. No, you know. You do it because it's something different about you than other folk. And I look back on my experience, and I came to that conclusion that it's something different about my body. I'm either born with a defective regulator or I don't have one. I don't know which one it is. It ain't important. But something happens in me when I take one, and my experience shows me that. But that's not the only problem. Then there's something wrong with my mind, because my mind refuses to accept the fact that my body's powerless over this. And I get this overwhelming compulsion, no matter what it is, to take another one, even when I said I'm not going to. You know, it's Wednesday, and the book calls it restless, irritable, and discontent. I just call it bored, need something to do, and something come over me, and the thought comes, and I'm loaded. That's just it. No period of, you know, money loaded. That's just it. No period of premeditation. And then, you know, so I'm bodily and mentally different than other people. And the second step is also a conclusion I draw based on my experience. I tried to stop me many times. You tried to stop me. Course tried to stop me. My mama tried to stop me. My wife tried to stop me. Job tried to stop me. I couldn't stop me. You couldn't stop me. If it ain't a power bigger than me who could stop me, I'm in big trouble. I already knew I had a power, that I needed a power greater than myself. And I already knew that there was a power greater than me. Alcohol. I needed a power greater than it. And it was a conclusion I drew based on my experiences. And I came in here in that condition. What do I have to lose? And took that second step. And I love the way Tom went through them last night. The chapter to the agnostic is a hell of a chapter for a guy like me. A spiritual kindergarten, a starting place for me to get in touch. I was listening to Tom. That was me. Violently anti-religious. When I turn 16, you'll never have to worry about Ralph White darkening the doors of anybody's church again. And that's the condition I came in here in. And I found, and you guys introduced me to something. And the way that I saw that power, you know, I couldn't see him, but I saw the evidence. It's like I can't see electricity, but I trust that it's on because I see the lights. I see the evidence. You know, I saw the evidence to God's work in the people around here. I trusted your stories, and I saw that you had clean faces and combed hair and fresh smiles. And Tom talked about the transformation the transformational power of the power. You know, so I did that deal, and that took me to the third step. Made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of this new power, as I understood him. And I didn't understand him. I had a sponsor to do this. I said, I'm going to turn my will and life over to God as I understand him. I don't understand him. He said, there ain't but two things you need to know about God to start the process. Number one, he is. Number two, he ain't you. And you know that's more than enough to start. You know, and I got him. So from that beginning, and like Tom, you know, I take this step and I do it. I renew that vow. It's like marriage. But I renew that commitment verbally because I stand on the third every day that I'm breathing. But I renew it verbally every year with a group of people. And I get on my knees in a circle and we hold hands. And the power of the power, you know, that flows through. And I do that third step prayer just like it's outlined, and I renew that commitment, and I get in touch with that power. Now, a lot of people have done third steps, and I don't know if anybody out here might have heard themselves say, I turn my life, my will and my life over. I keep turning it over, and I keep taking it back. I keep turning it over, and I keep taking it back. What's wrong with me? Well, that third step decision can have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in me that block me from the sunlight of that spirit. God ain't out there. He's in here, but I can't see him. Can't feel him. Can't touch him. Blocked. You know, by 33, when I came in here, I was 33 years old. And 33 years of living my life on my will. Two wills at work all the time. My will, God's will. God loves me so much, he won't impose his will on mine. You want to impose his will on mine. You know, you want to be a fool, go ahead, have at it. You're still my boy, and I'm still going to be dispensing grace. You just block from it. You know, I do visuals. You know. Because God do what God do. God do. You know, I remember being new to the program, and, you know, and I'm rolling, and I'm thinking to myself, you know. And I go to a meeting. I got about 4 months, and I go to this meeting, and this guy is at the meeting, old timer. I don't know how you guys, you know, now that I've been doing this a long time, I'll be thinking, you know, where did you guys go to get this old timer wisdom? Bob, you guys have these one liners. I'm supposed to have them now. You know, where did you guys go to get them? You know, because I'm rolling to this meeting. And this guy says, hey, Ralph, how you doing? What you into? I said, oh, I'm just doing God's work. And he said, what you think you can do for God that God can't do for himself? He floored me because I'm a right answer guy, right? And I thought that was the right answer because I give right answers. I've always been good at school. I'm a high achiever. I did that whole deal, you know. But he floored me. But the thing about being the right answer guy, when I was new this time with the fresh behind whooping, you know, I was humble enough. I got the one thing that I have to bring to this deal. Nobody can bring it for me. And that's the willingness. That's willingness. And I only know one thing that brings on willingness, and that's a well whooped behind, and I had mine, you know. And so I came in, and I had the humility. And so I asked this guy in all sincerity, well, wait a minute. I thought, what's my deal? What's my deal? He said, Ralph, your job is to do for God's kids. God's job is to do for you. God loves you so much, he gave you something he didn't even keep for himself. I said, what is that? He said, he gave you the power to choose whether you're going to return his love. God don't have no choice. God is love. That's all he do. That's all he do. So when you all around here and some people talk about we the chosen few, I don't know where that come from. God don't do choosing. That's a human attribute. God do loving. God do grace. God do dispensing grace. That's what he do. Now the rest of it, I get in the way. I impose my will on folk. I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. And sometimes you blame God for Ralph's behavior. Sometimes I blame God for me reaping the benefits of my own stuff. It's some spiritual axioms and some spiritual laws that work same way as it's some physical laws that work. If you throw something up, it's coming down. If there are some things that if I do them, I'm going to get what it is that I have coming to me. Every now and then I don't. Every now and then I don't. And sometimes I get what I don't have coming. That's grace. Unmerited gift. Sometimes I don't get what I do have coming. That's mercy. A lot of times I get what I have coming. That's justice. You know, but anyway, getting back to this deal, this whole idea of the fourth step. Check this out. There's a part in the third step that says, being convinced that my life run on my will can hardly be a success. Am I convinced that my life run on my will is not successful? If my life run on my will is successful, for the rest of you guys, just sit here and audit the rest of this deal we're going to do this morning. For those of us whose lives are a train wreck, either waiting to happen or that has happened, let's talk about it, you know. But if your life run on your will is successful, don't do inventory. Don't do inventory. I don't understand sponsors to be arguing with people about, you know, doing certain stuff. How's it working for you? You know? How's it working for you? You know, that's the way I am. You know, sometime I could, you know, and one of my resentments, and we'll talk about resentments and their power. You know, and one of the ways I would get resentments is I would want more for you than you want for yourself, and I would want to impose that on you. Third step talks about, you know, always in collision with somebody else, even when my motives are right. You might have a mate, you know, you got somebody smoke too much, don't eat the way you think they should eat, and get resentful, get to telling them about that, and they get to telling you, you would look good getting you some business and staying out of my name, you both mad. Yeah. But I'm only looking out for you. That might be true. Might be true. But I end up with the resentment, you know. And so, anyway, so this business of resentment. So let's talk about it. You know, the book talks about being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. So the common manifestations of self is what we're talking about. And the reason we're talking about it is I'm trying to get in touch with this power. You know, steps one and two are conclusions I draw based on my experience. Step one is the problem. Step two is the solution. The rest of the steps, the 3 through 12, the 10-step program of action to get to the solution. And the action really starts, like Tom said last night, at the fourth step. And the whole purpose of that, the whole purpose of this entire exercise, is I got to remember. See, I'm some 23 plus years removed from my last one, but I got to remember the desperation. And if anybody in here is new, if anybody in here is new, if anybody in here is returning, you know, a lot of times people come back in the program and people say when you stand up, oh, I applaud your courage and you know, you're so great. I pray you desperation. Later for courage, I pray you desperation, you know. I pray you desperation. And I still try to cling to the same desperation. So it's some subtle writing in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. But boy, when Bill says certain things, perk your ears up. When that squiggly writing shows up, perk your ears up. Or when he says something like, remember, we deal with alcohol. Remember, we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. So I've been relieved of something, you know, but it can have little permanent effect, you know, unless it once followed. So I'm in this effort to connect with this power. Initially, I need the power so it can keep that bottle out of my mouth. Initially, that's what I'm here for. At bottom, that's still what I'm here for. But what I learned is, in order for that to happen, some things had to happen for a guy named Ralph. Total transformation. Change in attitude, values, you know, and beliefs. You know, so this alteration in the way that I am. And the thing that happens when you come out the other end of that process, I'm going to give you some promises. The thing that happens when you submit to this process, submit is not a word I like, but I use it anyway because that's really what it implies. The thing that happens, because the third step is a promise to submit to the process will turn over my will and my life. Don't worry about how it happens. Don't worry about, you know, getting this understanding, you know, don't worry about that. The power will improve my understanding of the power. Don't trip off the fact that I don't, ooh, God, these guys are going to get up over the weekend and listen to Sandy Beach and Tom Iverster and Bob. I can't believe like they do. I don't feel it like they do. I don't have to for me to start getting results that I'm going to get for myself. That's the good news. That's the good news. I can start right where I am. And so I started at that third step, and then I get into this fourth step. And the fourth step, you know, is an effort to face and be rid of the things of me. So it talks about the common manifestations of self. Two wills at work all the time. Self-will, God's will. Self-will, God's will. Process of recovery, distill, grow God, reduce wrath. Talks about I won't be able to survive a certain trials and low spots unless I enlarge and perfect my spiritual life through self-sacrifice and working with others. Enlarge and perfect, bigger and better my spiritual life. Bigger and better. Grow it. Bigger and better. So distill to the common, grow God, reduce wrath. It's the whole deal. How do we do it? That's what we talk about this weekend. That's what all of us will be talking about. You know, for the rest of the weekend, you know, grow God, reduce me. First thing I have to do is see me. And the fourth step is an effort to face and be rid of the things in me that block me. A lot of times when I wrote a fourth step, the first time I wrote a fourth step, I wrote it in a treatment center and I wrote down all I knew about myself already. And the true effort, the true benefit of a fourth step is not to write down everything I know about me, but it's to discover what I don't know about me. It's to discover the truth about the stock and trade is what he says. And so when I talk about the common manifestations of self, the way Ralph shows up in everyday life. And Bill talks about three areas in particular. And these three areas, I love when Bob talked about in human relationships, I'll see a mirror to myself. So we're going to look at three areas of human interaction. That if I look at these three areas, I will be put on a path that really leads to a connection to a power that's unshakable. And so the first area I'm looking at, and it's interesting to me, these three areas, resentments, fear, and sex. Resentments, fear, and my sex conduct. I'm going to look at those three areas. And I think it's interesting to look at those three areas because those three areas, you know, although they seem to cause me more problems than anything else, what they arise out of is basic human instincts. The instinct for sex is human. It's innate, and it's nothing wrong with it. If we did not have that drive, that urge, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here. There would be no procreation. There would be no, you know, we wouldn't be sitting here. So that instinct and that drive is human. In folk like us, we take the normal instincts and we take them to excess. I want more than I'm due and more than is reasonable to expect. And so I get caught up in it, and so I take it to excess. And so that's why we look at it. And the reason it's so troublesome is because it is a basic human instinct. We're not going to get rid of that, and it's nothing. That's the reason why it is so troublesome, because it's not abnormal, and it is normal, and it has an intended function. Same for fear. Same for fear. If this room catch on fire, some adrenaline rush called fear is going to come over most of us. Hopefully, we're not going to trample each other, but we're going to get out of here real fast. We're not going to meditate about it and think about it for a long time. No. That adrenaline is going to spike immediately. And so the same as if you saw a snarling, barking dog coming, rabbit in the, you know to run. No, that's nothing wrong with that kind of fear. That's a healthy fear. It's a healthy fear. You know, you don't just come tight roping on the edge of some cliff and looking, oh, yeah, okay, and I'm not scared. No, that's a healthy fear. So it's instinctive and it's innate, and so it's particularly troublesome. Resentments. Well, Ralph, how is that healthy? Well, any kind of social progress, any kind of civilized progress, there are some things that people resent. Everybody. You know, if you see an injustice, you should get pissed off about it. And yeah, I resent that. I resent racism. I resent people, you know, who mistreat people. I resent people who molest babies and hurt people. You know, so that kind of deal, it comes up. But those are healthy because they don't immobilize. They motivate to positive action. Throughout history, folk have stood on, okay, there are some things that go on, and I'm not going to take it, and that's, you know. And some folk even mistakenly say, I stay sober off of resentment. Somebody told me I would never get new. Okay, that's something you know. Okay, you know. Okay. Just because I claim it don't mean it's so. I'm sober on the grace of God. That's it. That's all. I can ascribe a whole bunch of other stuff to it if I want to. You know, but folk run around here, I'm going to show them. And if it is something that is empowering in connection with something else, you know, little guy running back, you never make it. Okay. If it's empowering in connection with, I got a work ethic, I got drive, I got ambition, and now I'm going to let that fuel it. Okay. So that instinct is also there. But for us, this business of resentments is fatal because I take it to the nth degree. Now, the reason why I talked about that, because most people think in the book, it talks about this idea of resentments. Resentment is the number one offender. It has the power to kill more alcoholics than anything else. And if I was to ask anybody in here right now, how many people believe that resentments have the power to kill? Okay, we got a bunch of suicidal people in here because I guarantee you we got every. How many of those same people that raised their hands are probably suffering with some resentments right now? Intellectually, when I read the book, I think I know that, but I don't believe resentments have the power to kill. Because every now and then I think a good one, a well-nursed grudge, every now and then I think it's worth it. And I think every now and then... I think every now and then you have it coming to you, and I'm just the one to give it. Now, some of that sounds humorous, but when I look at the evidence of my life, check this out, you know. Because what happens if I let you get away with this one? What's going to happen next time? You'll do it worse. And if I don't take care of me, who will? If I don't take care of me, who will? Won't the world run over you? Won't people take advantage of you? If you let somebody hurt you this time, you know, it's been times, you know, where am I married people at? You know, there are times in a marriage when you might not really be mad at your mate, but you got to act like it because you just can't let this one go, right? Because if you let it go, what's going to happen next time? So it's been times when I'm not really mad, but I manufacture it. Because you got to be checked. You got to get stopped at the borderline right here. Because if not, you in my space. You know, and somebody's got to protect that. You know, in the book, it talks about a new angle of looking at things. You know, and this new angle is about me not protecting. So me not protecting me, but this power protecting me. But on the front end of the fourth step, I'm not tied into this power yet. I'm not tied into this power. So when I get to the fourth step, Bill talks about, he makes an analogy. He calls an inventory. You know, he talks about a fact-finding and a fact-facing. You know, he calls it a fact-finding, fact-facing enterprise. And he makes the metaphor, he calls it like a business, commercial inventory. He says a business that fails to take regular inventory will usually go broke. Run a Best Buy, right? Got a Best Buy. You got all this brand new stuff in there, you know, or you should have all this stuff in there. And Christmas season is coming, and you know you need all these people to come in here and buy your stuff. And for some reason, your store ain't making no money. You ain't never done inventory. Your store ain't making no money. And you're wondering why stuff is not going off your shelf. And you know, Irvin comes by, big old truck. He's a rep for, you know, Dell or somebody, and he's got these Xboxes and the latest, man, and he's got all this new stuff to deliver, and he calls on you, but you don't have no room on your shelves. And you've never taken the time to find out why. And you look around, and finally somebody convinces you, well, maybe you want to do inventory. See why your store is going broke. So you don't have room for the new Xboxes, and you don't have room for the latest gear, and because on your shelves, you still got Betamaxes in the box. Betamax is never sold, and they certainly aren't going to be selling in 2009, but I never clear my shelves. And I say to myself, but they're brand new, untouched, and they're mine, you know. And the book talks about we can't lie to ourselves about values. And, you know, and so you got those back there, and you got some old reel-to-reels and some old, you know, just all this old stuff that you've never gotten rid of. Some of it is damaged. Folk that came through the store and damaged it. Some of it's brand new, but it's not selling. Nobody's buying. It's unsellable. It's not usable. And the other stuff is damaged. And I can't lie to myself about values. Yeah, they look good in the box, but get rid of them. They're not coming back. Same thing with my thinking. Same thing with me. What's my stock and trade? My thinking. And so I go back in there and I need to have these old ideas and these old thoughts and these old behaviors and these old attitudes replaced by some new ones. Place by some new ones. You know, somebody, if your daddy came up with a big, 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 gigantic truck, and it was filled with brand new furniture, and he said, I'm gonna put all this in your house, but first you gotta clean out all that other stuff. Every one of us would hurry up and clean. Well, this whole idea of getting on this spiritual path is like that. The problem is I can't see the truck and I can't see my daddy. I can't see the truck and I can't see my daddy. So I got to trust what Tom says to me, that I cleaned my house up and my daddy drove a truck up. But since I'm a to the head right now person, if the truck don't come right now, I don't want to clean up my house. Because I'm a to the head right now guy. And the process of recovery and the long road of reconstruction that I got on, and when I signed up for this duty, October 11, 1986, I signed up for big boy duty. And grown people ain't about fun all the time and right to the head right now. It's about process. That's scary to me. Don't know nothing about that. I know how to start, forget finishing. Love when Bob was talking yesterday. That's what I am. I'm a starter. You know, I'm an acquirer, but I'm not a keeper. You know, and so that's the nature of who I am. And one of the reasons why, you know, we do this together as a group is because nowhere in the world do people want to recognize what we're doing when you're supposed to be doing. Why am I supposed to get a medal for doing what I should have been doing all my life? Ooh, you know, newcomers come in. You know, I got paid, and I paid all my bills this way. Ooh, you know. And, you know, you go tell that to, and what? Folk been doing this all their life. You know, but we want a medal for it, and check this out. We give medals for it in Alcoholics Anonymous. When you knew, we call them chips. Because folk like us, for better or for worse, we get in our groups, and we get in our groups, and we get in our groups. And even though other folk may not recognize the toll it takes to be grown, even though other folks may not recognize what it means for somebody like me to stand up and actually be a father, even though other folk don't do it, in here we recognize each other, whether it's for right or wrong. One of the reasons why we are in such a powerful fellowship, unity, recovery, and service. And that unity part, for a guy like me, it does get important. It does. It loses its importance, but it never loses its some significance. So we do that and we recognize that. But the deal about this driving the truck up and doing that deal, you know, so that whole idea, you know, that whole idea of resentment inventory, if you find yourself running into the same walls in relationships, if you find yourself having the same relationship with different faces, same person, different faces, if you find yourself having problems continually with people at work, people in the community, people in the meetings, if you find yourself continually having problems with people in my own household, if you're in that number, might want to try something different. Resentment inventory. Inventory is, if you want a taste of freedom, You know, when and in doing inventory, and we're going to talk about it. I brought some handouts. I'm going to talk about the mechanics of resentment inventory also, in addition to talk about the value of inventory. I'm going to talk about the mechanics of it. And in order to embark on a resentment inventory, it's a couple of things I need to know off the top. Number one, being free of a resentment does not mean that I condone, excuse, or exonerate the behavior that brought it on. And that's only for some. Because every now and then, real people do real hurt to real people. So sometimes I will hold on to a resentment because if I let the resentment go, am I not saying that I now condone the behavior that brought it on? How can I let go of resentment at a stepdaddy that molested me when I was 10 years old? Ralph, what you asking me to do? Am I saying that was all right if I let go of that resentment? That resentment is the only thing that's protected me. That resentment is what I've been nursing all my life. That resentment is what I've been holding on to let me know that what he did wasn't right, and somebody needs to know that. And I cannot let that go. Well, holding on to the resentment has been killing who? Killing me. Having a resentment is like me taking the poison and waiting on you to die. Another friend of mine says, me having a resentment is like me putting you in prison, but I got to stand guard. Right up in there with you. So this business of resentment, we find it infinitely grave. The book talks about the power, to the extent that we spend a bunch of time on it, the hours we spend nursing a resentment. You know, it talks about its futility and its fatality. Nothing, it's leading to nothing, and it's killing me. And it's killing me. We set these resentments on paper. Book gives clear-cut directions. You know, the 12 and 12 later on talks about a resentment, talks about inventory, talks about assets and debits. You know, in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it talks about we face the things in us that have been blocking us. The things in us that have been blocking us. So the resentment inventories that I do, and I'm going to pass these out, and there's some handouts, and, you know, we'll pass them out because I like people to visualize what it is I'm talking about. You know, and trust me, this is not the resentment inventory and the way to do resentment inventory. It's the way Ralph does resentment inventory. The way Ralph does resentment inventory. Put it in your toolbox. Use it if you find it valuable. You know, if not, you know, share about it, talk about it, write about it if it gives you a resentment. You know, but it's the way I do resentment inventory. And in doing resentment inventory, I ask myself a question. Doing resentment inventory, I ask myself a question. Because the deal about holding on to a resentment is my rightness in my position. Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? Thing about being right is it judges you as wrong. And the thing about being right is it makes me better than you. So sometimes when I hold on to a resentment, which makes me right and you wrong, what it also feels like to me is it makes me better and it makes you less. Bill talks about, as in war, the victor only seemed to win. Because the truth of the matter is nobody wins when I'm nursing resentment. So when I do resentment inventory, I do what it says in the book. Take a look at people, places, and institutions whom I'm angry. First thing we need to talk about, what's a resentment? That's not rhetorical. Somebody can help me if you want to. I'm an interactive guy. I don't know if Dick wanted this, but I'm interactive. What's a resentment? Somebody. Refill something. I'm going to get graphic because I think we all grown. I could think about the best sex I had. I could stand up here and refill that right now. And trust me, I'm not mad. Is that a resentment? To refill something. The feeling I got on Christmas Day when I got that glove, sometime I can remember back to that, and I can refill that, and it was my best Christmas ever. And I don't resent that. That's not a resentment. To refill something. Somebody help me. Resentment.
Anger plus 24 hours.
Anger plus 24 hours. Now we're getting there. Resentment.
Anger plus
He said to refill something, and then he added anger. To refill what? A hurt, ill feeling, injury, right? So there's another component to resentment other than just refilling something. To refill a hurt, to refill an ill feeling, what was that?
Injury.
And to refill an injury. And to refill an injury or a sense of wrongdoing. So to refill, so now we're getting there. So we refill. It's not just an anger that boils up. That's anger. If you let it go, then you cool. Problem is, if I get angry and then when I leave here, I get angry because I walked in the room and Dick and Tom and Bob, they were huddled up talking, and I looked at them and they looked at me and they stopped talking and they started laughing. Oh, I know they were talking about me. See, the injustice and the ill can be real or imagined. The resentment has the same power. Same power. And the way it plays out in my life and in my meeting life is when they do that and I leave this meeting and I replay it in my mind, I think to myself, plus I saw Dick smirking. And you know how Dick is. You know, and Tom and Bob, they're supposed to be my boys. Why are they over here with the, you know, so now I'm mad at them. I don't stop there because I'm me. I don't know about any other alcoholics. But that whole meeting is conspiring against me. And I know it. Later for that meeting, I can go somewhere. And pretty soon, later for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, that seems like a silly example. But we lose more and more people to resentment. Stop coming to meetings. You know, I knew he wasn't. How many people say this one? I knew he wasn't walking like he was talking. Look at her, look at him, he's doing the thing. And pretty soon, I leave my medicine. I leave the hospital because I'm mad at some of the other patients. It's crazy. I'm in the trauma center, emergency ward, in the emergency ward, you know. And in our trauma center emergency ward, you know, sometime it crosses over with Nut House too. So I know it's some of them people in there, and I get mad because you are who you are, and mainly because I am who I am too. And I get mad and leave my help. Leave my help. Sounds crazy, right? That's what I do. That's what I do. Resentments. So I put them on paper. Made a list of people, institutions, and principals with whom I was angry. And for me, when I do resentment inventory, I'm going to talk about mechanics for a minute. I don't know. Maybe somebody in there, maybe people have done inventory before. Maybe we got somebody who's never done it. When I do inventory, the first thing I do when I do this list, first column list, I start looking at broad categories. And it helps me because I go back as far in my life as I can go back. I go back, I start with family, friends, classmates, if you've been in the military, you know, if you've been in the work, you know, I look at employers, I look at employment, I look at the fellowship, broad areas of people, church, you know, broad areas of people. And it helps me to now distill and to think about the people. I say a prayer before I do it. God, show me what I need to see. Show me what I need, you know, and show me what's blocking me. And then I say that prayer, and then the names come, and I write them. So I do that, you know. Institutions, the institution of marriage, the IRS, they were garnered, you know. They had me. We won't talk about them. I still got one of them. You know, the IRS, UCLA, you know, institutions. Principles. What are principles that you might be mad about? The girls can't do what the boys can do. You know, nice guys finish last. You know, principles. You know, honesty is the best policy. Sometimes I'm mad at some of those. So I list them, but primarily for most people at the beginning, you know, persons and institutions, you know, is a pretty good starting point. So I look at that and I write them down. You know, and that's the first column. And then I lay it out just like it's laid out in the book. I do the second column. And the second column is the easy column. It's the column where I've been living most of my life. I call it the finger pointing column. Second column is the cause. The cause. Why I'm resentful. And when I do the second column, succinct, quick answers. Don't write a treatise. Don't write an essay. You know. Yeah, he came over one day and he promised that he would give me my money back and he never repaid the money he borrowed, blah, 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 owes me money. owes me money. Don't be redundant. He lied to me and he never tells the truth. Same resentment. Lied to me. If you go over three or four words, it may be too much. It's your resentment inventory. You know what it means. Short and quick to the point. If I have an and an or, it's probably another resentment. He lied to me and he stole my money. Lied to me. Stole my money. Separate resentments. I have to put an and. And then I go to the third column. What it affects. Big book lays out the seven areas of self that's affected. The seven areas of self that I look at. I don't have to create some new ones. I look at those seven areas of self. And those definitions that I provided are my definitions. We do a big book workshop. Tom was talking about taking some people through the big book. And since 1987, my brother and I and another friend of ours, we started a workshop at my mom's house, the same mom that I damn near killed when I was out there drinking. And we started a workshop on Sunday mornings at her house with 12 people. And that was back in November of 1987. And we started going through the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous line by line, page by page. And we only go through chapter 7, the chapter working with others where the 12 steps is contained. Because it takes us about 14 months to just get all the way through there. It's a really painstaking exercise. Some people say, why you guys take so long? I don't have nothing else to do on Sunday morning. I'm going to be here for the long haul. I'm not in a hurry. If people want to do it another way, no, that's fine. You know, but on Sunday mornings, you can find me, you know, sitting with a blue book cracked open. And we go through it and we share our experiences with what's in there. And we only focus on the paragraph that was read right then. And we started doing that in November of 1987. And we go through it with a group and we finish the seventh chapter and we take a month off and we open up with another group. And we started with 12 at my mom's house. And the next year we started with probably about 30 at my mom's house. And the next year after that we had graduated and we outgrew my mom's house. Now we're in our third place, our final place, and it's a big hall. And we open up and we open up with about 300 people the last time we opened. And we started with 12 and we've been doing that. You know, and it's the way I spend my Sunday mornings. And so I get the opportunity to sit down with some people. And so over the years, we've just developed some stuff that's just ours. You know, and if you find it useful, find it useful. And in the third column, it looks at the areas of self that's affected. I ask myself which one of these, which one, two, three, or all seven of these areas. You know, my self-esteem, how I think about myself. You know, my pride, what I think other people think about me. You know, my security, what I think I need to be okay. My ambition, what I think I want to be okay. You know, my pocketbook, that's self-explanatory, my money, my property, sex relations, any relationship where sex is involved, real, imagined, or potential. You know, and my personal relationships, any relationship where sex is not involved, my friendships, my other relationships. And I look at those seven areas of self. And I look at those areas, and when I do the third column, I do what we call an extended third column. I write a little sentence in addition to it because I want to see myself. I want to see the truth about myself. I want to see what's blocking me from my relationships with other people. I want to see the patterns because in the patterns I'll see what it is. You know, that's my belief system about what I need to be okay and about my interactions with other people. And more importantly, what it is that separates me from you and me from this power. You know, the book talks about after I take a look at this, digest some real chunks of truth about myself, one fact stands out real clear about me, that I found that the world and its people really dominated me. And that's me. I'm trapped by what I think you think about me. And the world and its people really dominated me. In that state, the wrongdoings of others, fancy to real, I just imagine they talking about me, had the power to actually kill. I'm out of here. I'm out the hospital. I'm out the trauma center because I imagine that they talking about me. And the wrongdoing of others, fancy to real. But anyway, I take a look at that, and I brought an example along. It's a real resentment that I had about my dad, you know. And on that last page of resentment inventory, it's a sample format. My dad, the cause, he left us. And I only wrote about one of the causes. When I do an inventory, I write about each cause in that third column and the fourth column separately. So I only wrote about the first cause, which is why I wrote a one. You know, he left us. What did that affect in me? It affected my self-esteem. If I was important to him, then he wouldn't leave me. It affected my pride. I didn't think my father thought much about me at the time. And check this out. I thought other people who knew that I didn't have a daddy in the house thought less of us, too. You know. Affected my ambition. I wanted a complete family. I wanted to leave it to be. I wanted a Cosby family. You know. Affected my ambition. My security. It affected the way what I thought I needed. I needed a father's love. I needed a father's protection. I needed a father's guidance. You know, my personal relationships. I never had a close relationship with him, and I didn't have some close relationships with other people that I thought would find out that we had a one family house. And check this out. I am so dominated by myself, and I'm so in self-centered fear, and I'm so self-absorbed with myself. More people than not in my neighborhood didn't have a father in the house, but I felt like I was the only one that was like that. I felt like I was the only guy who showed up at the father-son banquet with his uncle. And looking back, a whole bunch of cats were like that. But I was consumed with me. I can't see you. So when you knew, when you in here and you think everybody's worried about you, check this out. You in a room full of people that self-absorb with themselves. You know, ain't really got a lot. And I get worried that they all thinking about me. You the news for a minute, then we move on. You know, sex relations. My father left me when I was a kid. What does that have to do with my sex relations? What does that have to do? Everything. Everything. I never had a man model what it is to be a man in a family. I never had a man model what it is to be a man in a relationship. And more importantly, I intake differently. And the way I intake is I am the seed of this man. He embarrassed me. I wasn't proud of him. And it ended up making me feel like, you know, if you really know me, yeah, I'm a good starter. And yeah, I can make a superficial impression. But if you know me, girls ain't going to like me. I'm not going to be enough. So I buy my way into relationships. You know, and I'm always afraid that you're on the verge of leaving me because I don't know what it is to be a man. I could play the role for a time. But when it gets one-on-one time and you really get to know me, you'll find out. You'll find out. You know, I didn't go to my high school prom. Late bloomer. I'm a real late bloomer. I always had a lot of fears about this manhood thing and thought the rest of you guys had a handle on it. You know, I started drinking when I was 16. You know, late bloomer. My daddy was alcoholic. I said I'd never be like him. I started drinking then, and I didn't have sex till I was 18 years old when I graduated from high school, and my girlfriend forced that up on me, you know, but because, see, not only am I scary, I'm scared to let you know I'm scared, so I'm a perpetrator, I lie, and I don't ever cop to it. I never told a girlfriend, and you know, I'm the kind of guy that hides behind a good motive, you know, my real thing. I would tell my girlfriend at that time, oh, no, the rest of these guys, they just want you. I'm playing the chivalrous role. You know, we shouldn't do anything until we get married. I'm 16, yeah, we gonna get married. You know, but I'm playing that role. Didn't go to my high school prom. It was the 60s, and it was a political time, and I said it was a political statement. I don't believe in prom. I was scared. I was scared that on prom night she was going to demand that I do something. I didn't know what to do, you know, and that used to terrify me. Fellas, I would lay in bed at night terrified of, you know, girls think probably, and I'm going in a woman's head now, of my first night when I would be terrified because guys ain't supposed to have a first night. I would be terrified that she would know I don't know what to do. And on prom night, I didn't go to the prom, you know. But anyway, let's get back to inventory. Too much information, you know. So anybody out there that's thinking to themselves, I remember being new and be thinking, now, what was I thinking? But somebody is probably thinking to themselves, ooh, it would be fun to get up and be talking in front of the group. You know, this thing right here, it'll draw out too much information. You know, don't play with it. You know, it just has that effect on me. You know, pocketbook. Definitely affected my pocketbook. My mother was on welfare raising 6 boys by herself. Mom wasn't the kind of lady that would settle for welfare, so she just started working real hard. 2 jobs, domestic work, you know, back to school, back to high school, back to college, you know, so we didn't have a lot, you know, and another income would have helped, you know, so yeah, it affected my pocketbook. 4th column, freedom column. What's my part in this? Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous has a sentence in there. It's one of my favorite sentences, one of the most freeing sentences in the book. Doesn't read like that, but it is like that. It says, our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. If the problem is in me, the solution is in me. I don't have to wait for you to get better for me to get better. Promise is held out in the steps. I don't have to wait for you to get better for me to get better. Ralph, do I always have a part? I look for my part. I search for my part. Sometimes until my defects are gone, I let my defects work for me. You are not going to own me. Whoever I'm resentful at, I'll say that to myself when I'm doing resentment inventory. You're not going to own me. Because a person that I'm resenting, they own me. They rob my happiness. They rob my peace of mind. You can't go to family gatherings because that brother or that sister or that uncle is going to be there. They own me. I see them in my presence, and my whole attitude and outlook changes. My demeanor changes. I have to leave. I have to act in a way I don't want to act. I start getting cranky, and I start getting irritable, and I start picking fights. I start doing something. And the thing about me with a resentment, I don't know how to just compartmentalize it. When I'm mad at everybody. Anybody ever been out somewhere, and you know, you might be double dating, and the couple get mad, and you know, now it's frosty in the car with every, I'm that guy. I'm that guy. I don't know how to, I don't have that. I shut down with everything, everybody. So what's in the fourth column? My part, you know. The book talks about disregarding the other person entirely. We tried to look at where we've been at fault. What were our mistakes? You know. So I look at my part. I was selfish. And I also have some definitions for the fourth column that I use for myself. Selfish because I was only concerned with how his leaving affected me with no regard for his feelings, needs, or capabilities. I wanted my dad to be a Cosby dad, and my dad wasn't Bill Cosby. I wanted him to be something other than what he was. My dad was a janitor with a 7th or 8th grade education. He wasn't Dr. Huxtable. He couldn't have been Bill Cosby if he wanted to be. Sometimes I have resentments that are beyond a person's capability. I expect somebody has a resentment at their parents, expecting them to be Susie Homemaker. She's who she is. My dad was a janitor who was a drunk. He couldn't be other than what he was. I never thought about my dad. You know, my dad left us. I never thought about, did he hurt at night thinking of his 6 sons? I never thought about, did he feel overwhelmed and crushed with the responsibility of raising 6 boys on a minimum wage salary. I never thought about that. He left us. I was selfish because I was only concerned with myself. I was dishonest because when he was there, I wanted him gone. Didn't like him, didn't respect him, didn't dislike him, just didn't like him, didn't respect him. He made me embarrassed. He wasn't the guy that you bring to school and the other kids say, ooh, that's your dad. So I didn't even want him coming to the school anyway. You ever been in that catch-22? You resent him because he never showed up with you. But you didn't. If he was showing up, you would be distancing yourself. But that's how I can think. I'm self-centered. I'm self-absorbed. I only think about me, you know. I was dishonest because my dad didn't leave us. My mom put him out. That was a revelation, and the cool thing about it was I knew it. When I write inventory, I write with present-day brain. I don't write with 8 or 9-year-old brain. I might write the inventory. I might write the resentment that I've been nursing since I was 8 or 9. But when I write about it, and I write in my fourth column, I write from present-day thinking. And present-day thinking, I knew my mom had put them out. But the resentment, because I just operate without pen to paper, I just operate with something rattling around in my brain. The resentment always rattled around in my brain as if he left us. But when I went pen to paper, it was an aha moment. Oh, wait a minute. Your mom put him out. You don't know if he felt, if he cried. You don't know what he went through. Oh, my God, you know. Now, I was dishonest because that was between his mom, my mom and him. As a grown person, I know that now. I know that now. I know that when couples break up, that's casualties of. I was self-seeking because I refused to interact with him for years. I withheld myself from him. Wanted to elevate myself at his expense. myself seeking because I belittled him to my brothers at every opportunity. Diminished him to enhance me. Self-seeking. And then here's the one. Sometimes people have resentments that really seem as if they're justified. Those are be careful. Be careful. Because a justified resentment is the same poison as an unjustified resentment. Same poison. Same poison. I'm justified, you know. Somebody in here right now, was molested by somebody. Was molested by somebody. Ralph, how do I get to the fourth column on that? What's my part on that? Why shouldn't I be able to resent the person for that? If I let the resentment go, am I not saying that what they did was okay? Let's walk backwards from that. If I hold on to the resentment, I'm protecting myself from that ever happening to me again. Well, I'm 45 years old. I'll never be a 10-year-old girl again with an uncle. Duh. Ooh, never thought of that. Never thought of that. I'm protecting myself from it ever happening again. Well, it was my daughter that got molested by my brother or the stepdad, the man I married, or somebody else close. So I got to have a resentment to protect her from. No, I don't. I just have to not let him come around her. The resentment isn't the protection. The resentment is not the protection. In fact, the resentment, me building fences and erecting structures to keep you out, are the barriers that have kept me in. Somebody in here, in that resentment, is unable to lay down with somebody else without a third person being between you and a bed right now. Somebody in here is unable to form real intimacy with a partner because of something that happened a long time ago right now. Somebody in here is unable to go to a family gathering because Uncle so-and-so or Cousin so-and-so is going to be right now. Somebody in here is not able to be a maximum service because I can't go anywhere any free man or woman can go because I'm trapped in the bondage of me right now. That's why I do it. Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? Do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? There's some areas and there's some stages that I go through in my recovery life, and I can see them and reflect it. You know, sometime in my prayer life, I can see how my recovery life is reflected. Early on, when I first come into recovery, my first stage of development has helped me. Almost every one of us get to this place that we get to, this place of recovery. None of us went to the steps drunk. Everybody was already sober when they started taking steps. So it's not the steps that get me sober. Whoo, what are you talking about? That's sacrilegious. You guys are talking about steps this weekend. It's not the steps that get me sober. How many people in here were sober before they even ever went to the steps? Almost all of us. I don't see nobody riding a four-step drunk. You know, nobody. You wasn't on the third step prayer still drunk. Some people might be, but you didn't get no benefits. You know. So what is it that you're trying to say, Ralph? Grace. 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 When desperation meets opportunity, I think it opens up a real sliver of a window. And if I jump through right then, if I jump through, each and every one of us went to that place. Desperation meets opportunity. Somebody came right then. I went to a meeting right then. Went to a program right then. Desperation meets opportunity, a thin window, because it was many times when it happened and I didn't jump through the window and I was still out there. And I went through the window. Grace found me. Grace found me. The key is staying in the state of grace. The key is continuing to stay connected to the power that's gracing me. Because he's going to keep throwing grace out. I just block it. I deflect it, you know, because I'm blocked. So that's what we're trying to do. Uncover and discard what's blocking me from the grace of God. And so when I do that, so the first thing, first phase of development for me, help me. Help me. Almost every one of us said it in various forms. Help me. And we get to that, and then I get to that third step that Tom talked about last night. Second phase, give me, grant me, the serenity. Grant me peace as I go from here, you know. And then we get to that last stage of development that most of us try to get to. And I'm beginning to get to that phase of development when I start uncovering, discovering in this card. Use me. Use me. Use me. As we go through the process of the rest of these steps this week, we'll get to a point where we talk about increasing in usefulness and understanding and effectiveness. I'm trying to become effective. I'm not trying to become a teacher. I'm not trying to become super knowledgeable. You know, I'm not trying to get real smart and intellectual. Make me useful. Make me effective. So when I start looking at that, when I look at it in the light of these resentments, you know, it changes everything. Changes. Do I want to be right or do I want to be free? Do I want to be right or do I want to be effective? So I'm sitting on that resentment that somebody can't talk about. Let's talk about it. Resentment is at stepdaddy. Cause molested me. What that affect? My self-esteem. Must be something wrong with me. I'm dirty. I brought this on. My pride. What I think other people think about me. He didn't think much about me, and the world knows I'm wearing this scarlet letter on me. Molested. Broken. Some damaged goods. What other people think about me. My ambition. Just wanted to grow up and be a normal little boy, a little girl. Just wanted to have a normal childhood. My security. Oh, absolutely. My physical security was not only hurt or threat. It wasn't threatened. It was hurt. It was interfered with. Physical safety. Personal relationships. Interferes with every succeeding relationship in my life. I probably hide out all the time. Don't let people know who I really am. Scared if you get too close to me, you'll see it on me. Because there's something wrong with me and I know it. I brought it on. Sexual relationships. Third person in the bed, if I can even have relationships with other people. Can't get too close. Intimacy, psh, please. Pocketbook, may or may not have been affected. Fourth column, my part. Speculation. Listen to enough fifth steps that sometimes I just take liberties and I share for some other people that ain't going to be able to share it out loud. What's my part? Selfish? Is it selfish for a little girl or a little boy to not think that they should have somebody invade or and impose themselves on? No, that's not selfish. That's not selfish. That's not selfish. Dishonest. Maybe, maybe not. Remember, resentments and resentment inventory is personal to you. It's your inventory. Nobody else can tell you what's effective. Nobody else can tell you what part you played in it. You have to look at it for yourself. One of the benefits in sharing, and one of the benefits from looking into other people, is sometimes I can see some stuff about me that I didn't know was about me. I was with somebody for the longest time, and my ex-wife was an incest survivor. And when she did her inventory in her fourth column, in dishonest, she would say it was dishonest because it started out as incest and it ended up as prostitution. Because she lived for the times when the stepdaddy would give her something, and she started exploiting that, and she started seeking him out for the gifts. It's not everybody's story. Sometimes it's dishonest because I never told anybody, and I expected them to take up for me anyway. I might have resentment in my mom because she never did anything. Well, did you ever tell anything? But if you can't find it in selfishness, and if I can't find it in dishonesty or self-seeking, I can always find it in fear. I can always find it in fear. I can always find it in fear. Afraid of being exposed, afraid of being humiliated, afraid of being hurt, afraid that people know, afraid that there's something wrong with me that brought this on, afraid that nobody will ever want me. Afraid that people will always be able to tell this about me. Fear. You can always find it in fear. And the key about inventory, do I want to be right? Do I want to be free? Do I want everything this program has to offer? Do I want to live happy, joyous, and free, or do I just want to settle? I'm one of the ones that I want everything it has to offer, so I look. So I look. The book talks about being considerate of others and always hard on ourselves. So I look. And I look with a harsh eye on myself because I'm after something. I'm after something that's different than what I've ever had. I'm after a relationship with a power that can do for me what I can't do for myself. And the only reason I believe in that is because I see evidence. That's why we come together in groups like we come together, because I see evidence. People tell me that their daddy drove a truck up and they got new furniture in their house. I see evidence because people told me. And I see the way they live, and I want the way they live. I want the way they live. And more than wanting the way they live, I don't want the way I'm living. If you want the third person out your bed, look. If you want to be able to get close to somebody, look. If you want to be able to have restored family relationships or go back to the family house on holidays, take a look. Resentment inventory, I'm telling you, it's the first step. A lot of times people will say, I did inventory and nothing else happened. Well, I might have stopped right there. This is a 12-step program, not a 4-step program. It's a 12-step program, not a 4-step program. So sometime when I'm writing inventory, and when I write inventory, there's some rules that I follow. When I write the 4th step, I don't think about the fact I'm going to do a 5th step. I don't even think about it. If I think about the fact I'm going to sit down and look my sponsor in the eye and I'm going to share this stuff, I might start editing or censoring. I just write. And I am as diligent as I can be. And I write down these resentments, you know, and I write them down and I write through as many people as I. How far back do you go, Ralph, as far as you can remember and whatever comes up? Well, what if I don't feel a resentment now? I write about it anyway because my mind has a mind of its own and it plays tricks on me. And my mind, and a couple of things happen in this process of inventory, especially resentment inventory. Two things are going to happen. You know, I call them twins and they pop up. And the twins are, you know, fear and pride. And fear is going to say, you know, you can't look. And pride is going to say, plus you don't have to. You've been doing fine on it just like this, you know. And so beware. Because this is an ego-deflating process, and my ego will fight to live. It will fight to live. You don't need to look at that. You not know, okay. And I will think it's dormant and let something else happen that hadn't happened in 3 weeks. And not only am I still mad at time, I done added another one. Now I get this new resentment, and I bring up the old one. Plus, remember when he did that? I write. I don't tell myself I'm over it now. I don't need to write about it. I write. If I've never written, it can't hurt to clean a clean house. It can be fatal to not clean a dirty house. It can be fatal. You put tomatoes in the bottom. You know you have your vegetable bin in the refrigerator, and you might put some fruit in there, or you might put some tomatoes, and you might have 10 perfectly formed tomatoes, perfect, ripe, one rotten one. What happens if that one rotten one sits in there with them 10 good ones? What happens? You better be taking a look. Because the one contaminates. The one contaminates. So I look. And I look and I clean. So I take a look at that. And then I do the inventory. And a lot of people want to stop there. It's scary to do, you know, and don't share it. I know most people would never do that. Because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of effort. It's a painstaking effort. That's why we say a fearless and thorough moral inventory. It's going to take some fearlessness for some of us. It takes more than it does for other folk. Some of us come from backgrounds that were not so pretty. Some of us really did have some stuff that happened in our history. Some of us do not want to look. But do I want the freedom? You know, has it been weighing me down all this time? You know, sometimes I don't even know it was weighing me down till I'm free of it. I thought I was a hunchback till I got, oh, shit, you mean that was something else? I can walk? You know, didn't even know. Thought it was a part of me, you know. And so I look and I get free of it. So don't sit up here and do a four-step and don't continue with the process of recovery, okay? Don't do a four-step and don't follow through. You know, I always like to say it, you know, I won't. I won't. Go ahead. Doing a fourth step and not taking a fifth is like having sex and not coming. Why do the work and not get... I warmed them up for you, Bob. They all want to do fifth steps now. Everybody wants to do a fifth. Ooh, I want to do a fifth. I know my crowd, you know. And then I do a fifth and I do a sixth and I not, because it's all a process of uncovering, discovering, and discard. It's all a process of getting close to the power. And it's not hard. It's in the seeking. It's not in the finding. It's not in the analyzing. It's not in the understanding. It's not in you. It's in the seeking. It's in the seeking. God don't make too hard of terms with those who seek him. As I draw near to him, he'll disclose himself to me. He'll show himself. He'll show himself, and it's in the activity of the step. You don't have to guess at it. Bob is going to come up here, and he's going to talk about, you know, first Michael's going to come up, and I can't wait for her. She'll talk about the other way self shows itself. Then Bob's going to come up here, and he's going to talk about continuing to uncover, discover, and discard the things in me that's been blocking me. We'll talk about a six and seven step. We'll talk about I can't do it for myself. A car never works on itself. It'd have to go back to the manufacturer, and that's what we do in the six and seven step. And then we'll talk about that. Tom will be back again talking about the eighth and the ninth step, you know, and the beauty of it. If you cannot get the freedom in the fourth step that you're looking for and in the fifth, the residue of it is found in the eighth step. I guarantee you, if you still got a resentment at somebody after you do a four and five, you probably owe them an amends, and it'll show up. The residue of the fourth, you'll find it in the eighth, and at the end of the ninth step, you'll be able to realize what the second step is. By now, we will have been restored. And I didn't mean to preview that, but I just said, you know, if you want the full benefit of the fourth, you got to continue the activity through the rest of the steps. Don't sit up here. I hear people say all the time, I did an inventory and I'm still in bondage. Well, it's not a four-step program. This is the start. It's the starting point. It's the effort to face and be real. It's fact-finding, fact-facing. Don't lie to yourself about value. Come on. If you want it, come on, get it. I'm out. My name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic.